So long before I became a Buddhist nun or a Buddhist, or a Theravadan Buddhist, I was, I took refuge in the Tibetan Buddhist tradition in Milwaukee in 95. And that would be similar to what we think of as taking the steps. But you're basically taking refuge in the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha. And so that's the first ceremony in Tibetan Buddhism that they have. And then later they take bodhisattva vows, if that's what someone wants to dedicate themselves to. So it was, I was in the, and that was the Shambhala tradition. So I did that for about 8 years. And then Bhante Sujata started teaching a group in Wisconsin where I lived, really about a quarter of a mile from where I lived, at a yoga studio in Williams Bay. And it had been getting harder and harder for me working and having teenage kids to go to Milwaukee. So I was still a member of the Shambhala, but I was not going and not practicing the way I had started out. And so I was excited about this Buddhist teacher coming to this. I never thought that would happen in this little touristy town in Wisconsin. And he taught a weekly meditation on Saturday after Saturdays at 5, because they had a service here, and then he'd come to Williams Bay. So he taught us maybe 6 or 7 months, and then he was coming to Sri Lanka, and he was really sick then when he got to Sri Lanka, so his visit was extended. So our group kept going in Williams Bay, and we just all took turns leading the meditation. And everybody was pretty new, you know, we weren't in the Theravadan tradition. So it was very quickly something that I saw just was really more, I was so much more comfortable with the teachings than I had been with some of the teachers in the Tibetan tradition. I could understand a lot more of it. And in the Tibetan tradition, I used to think, okay, I'm going to try and listen to all this, and maybe 5-6 years from now, I'll understand what. And the teachers would often say that, like, well, you know, you'll understand it at some point. So I really, it's very intellectual talks and very dense. And I was so new to it. It was, a lot of it was hard to understand, but the teachings still, with good teachers, the teachings came through really well. That with the same way it is with, like, Bhante Sujata and Bhante Rahula, a lot of kindness, very loving, and you got the gist through the way they were. So I let Shambhala know that the first time I took precepts here, I had let Shambhala know that I had made this transition over to the Theravadan position. So it was just kind of I had had really good experiences and had been introduced to the Dhamma in that one tradition, but Bhante Sujata's teachings and the Theravadan teachings in general, and the lack of, not so much in terms of ritual, and things were simpler to me and more direct in terms of accessing the Dhamma. So I did that before I even started coming to Woodstock, because he was coming to Williams Bay every week. And then I started coming later, it was a couple of, about 2 years later, he and I started talking about me ordaining. I was divorced and, you know, I was kind of waiting for my kids to get older and get out of high school. And I started coming more often here. We were down in the basement and just rented the space from the Unitarians. So I came here usually once or twice during the week. I think they only had a Monday night group. And so I would come here on that one evening, and Saturdays for a while he was still coming to Williams Bay. But I started coming here, and then took the five precepts with him and the eight precepts, and then I took my monastic precepts, which is a whole other thing. For women to be a bhikkhuni, you take 211 precepts.
Wow.
So studying those, the Vinaya is what it's called, studying that is just a whole thing in itself. And I think the male monks take like 177 or something. So some of the precepts for women are about how they have to be more aware, because of the culture back then. You couldn't travel alone, and you couldn't, there are a lot of, the monks had a certain relationship to the nuns, like they taught the nuns, but there were rules about how you couldn't get too close to a monk or touch a monk.
Is it nun or is it the person in general?
Specifically in our rules, guidelines, they're more like rules when you're a monastic. Including just with other people in general, the monks and nuns had specific rules about how they weren't to, do anything and be too close to each other. So the nuns have to live separately from the monks because they can't be seen going into the same door of a residence. You can't see men and women do that. It doesn't look right. So anything that looks a little suspicious, like if you lived in the same building, you had to have a separate entrance, and for the men and the women, and they had to be practically like just two separate buildings put together. So there are a lot of rules that were connected with those things that women had to be more aware of. So that added a lot of those extra ones. So that was when I stepped back from being a nun, I consider myself like an eight preceptor or lifetime precepts. And I don't have to study those 211 rules. Mm-hmm. Some of them are just very, you would think that they would have dropped them by now because they're really from an old culture. But to keep the teachings intact and to keep the purity in the monastic line, they've kept almost all of those. So that's several books are written about it and what they mean and what they. And different people have different ways they understand it. So it's monastics use the rules differently everywhere. But that's just kind of my history with the precepts. So Ivana started the beginning of the summer coming here. So this will be
January.
Oh, January. I thought you said June. I'm sorry.
How long have you been coming?
Oh, that's a long time. And then, yeah, Lori.
Like 2018?
2017 or 2018, I don't know.
And have you taken the precepts before?
No.
I think it's...
I see a ceremony and think, I need to do that, and I had the impression that it was a time commitment here during the day for some reason, and I don't know if this has been a time commitment the whole time, but that's why I haven't done it.
You mean...
I talked to her on Saturday, and she told me what it was, and...
You thought the preparation for it was a daytime activity?
Yeah, I was worried about having to be here during workdays.
Oh, yeah.
I told a story in my head that was totally wrong, and I'm sure I'm taking it right at the right time right now, so that's fine.
Yeah, it's, I think ever since we started, we've had the trainings either after or before service, or on Saturdays, like after or before, usually after, because most people work, and it's that we usually planned it that way. So that's good. You probably had enough time to soak in enough that you're even more comfortable with it. So I'm supposed to be speaking on a layperson's take on the precepts. So most of my Buddhist life has really been as a monastic. But I think the difference is, for a monastic, there are a lot of rules that are just to help for the monastics to live together, to live in communities with each other. And so it's they're very specific about how you organize your community as a monastic, and how you, if you have conflict with others in your group, say the monastics who might live in one area or one community, how you deal with them. There are lots of, in our sutta study, the book that we're reading in the sutta study for lay people, but I teach it online. It's one of Bhikkhu Bodhi's books, and it's about social harmony and community of Buddhist practitioners. And almost all the guidelines from the Buddha, he talks about, it's as if he's talking to the bhikkhus and the bhikkhunis about how to settle disagreements or conflicts, and what to do when someone's, you know, breaking all the rules and the other people in the group are having trouble with it. But it's very easy to take all those and think about the larger community. It doesn't just apply to monastics. Just in ways to have harmony in the community. And it actually involves for the monastics, if you're living in a group, that you have specific times set aside where you talk about the rules, and if someone needs to bring something up, they can bring it up. So the precepts are, I think, what the precepts are still what we're all working with, the monastics and lay people too. They're still, so the precepts, when you take the first precepts for both of you. So you start by taking refuge, just like we do every time we chant, taking refuge in the Buddha and the Dhamma and the Sangha. And then we always are working with the Four Noble Truths. And then the five precepts are then the basic, just like the basic ethical behavior. And really, those five pretty much cover everything that we need to give us kind of a very simple, easy way to remember. This is our foundation, our basic moral ethical foundation. And it's not that difficult, but you know, we spend a lifetime trying to master it, which is good. And then for the 8 precepts, we just add more about speech. It's the same 5, but then in addition to not telling untruths, the extra ones on speech are not to speak in harsh speech or chatter, which is like just the kind of loose talk that we do all the time and includes gossip. So it's harsh. I'm a horse. It's harsh speech and the meaningless speech. And what am I trying to remember? What's the other one for the 8? What are the 3 extra?
That's the next chapter. We're on chapter 1.
Yes.
So.
Oh, it's.
What do you have so far? Gossip? Wrong speech, maybe?
Well, truth is being honest is in the 5. Okay. Not to tell lies. And then when you go to 8, which we think of as lifetime precepts, the 8 precepts. Do you remember, Rebecca, what is the whole? You know what, I've got a book right here too with it. I've got this bhavana.
5, 8, bodhisattva vows.
There we go. We're working on the 5. It's harsh speech, useless speech or idle chatter, and malicious speech. So, and false speech is in the first 5. So the lifetime precepts are really just adding, they're the same, but adding those 3. So speech is really important. And it continues to be so important all the way through. So thinking about the 5 precepts, and also the 4 noble truths, because when we don't take any kind of we don't make any kind of commitment to the 4 noble truths, but the 4 noble truths are in the ceremony. We do the refuge, and then we repeat the 4 noble truths. And then we go into the 5 precepts, and then the 8 precepts, and the 10. And it's recommended that someone, the order is always the same, but it's recommended that if you want to take the 8 precepts, you would wait at least a year from the 5. It could be longer. And then to take the 10 bodhisattva vows, that would be at least another year. And so that's, some people wait longer between taking them, just until they are ready, they feel ready to do it. So I was reading a really good book. It's a Bhikkhu Bodhi book, but it's on noble truths, noble path. And so he has compiled teachings. So one of the things he's done in this book, he's compiled teachings on the 4 noble truths and the Eightfold Path. So he talks about those things and how important they are. And just reading through this, he talks about the way the Buddha would write a lot of suttas. He'd have one teaching in one section that would show up where Ananda, or either Ananda was memorizing the talk, or the talks will say either that the Buddha's talking, And Ananda, who was his personal secretary, would be the one who would often be the, who was the one who would memorize everything. And he might start it out with, as I heard, or thus have I heard, and then the talk. So if he wasn't there, the Buddha promised that he would, like if Ananda couldn't go to one of the Buddha's talks, the Buddha promised that he would come back and tell Ananda the same exact talk. So then Ananda would say, thus I have heard. So all of those were memorized, but with one group of people, he might give a little sort of a simpler description of the Four Noble Truths, or he would give them, but not with a lot of detail. And another time he would have the same, the same Noble Truths, but he would go deeper into it. And he'd talk a little bit more about what it meant, like what we're supposed to do with it. And that is, this is the one book that I see Bhikkhu Bodhi has done. He's put all of those together, and who the Buddha was talking to, and you know, so he pieces it all together, so you get all those parts. And one of the things that I thought was really interesting, how are we doing on time? Okay, thank you. He talks about, I'll just read a little bit of this, because do you know what the five aggregates are? Well, and that's something that it's not one of the first teachings you'll get either. So he's talking about a lot of the different talks on the Four Noble Truths. But in one of these, he says, there are amongst these Four Noble Truths. What for? The Noble Truth of Suffering, the Noble Truth of the Origin of Suffering, the Noble Truth of the Cessation of Suffering, the Noble Truth of the Way Leading to the Cessation of Suffering. And then he explains a little bit further, and this is the only sutta that I've seen this in. And what, monks, is the Noble Truth of Suffering? The five clinging aggregates, it should be said. That is, the form clinging aggregate, the feeling clinging aggregate, the perception clinging aggregate, the volitional activities clinging aggregate, and the consciousness clinging aggregate. This is called the Noble Truth of Suffering. So he's saying that the five aggregates of clinging, that's when we talk about the five aggregates, we're talking about the five components of like a human being or a being. And the aggregates are form, feeling, perceptions, volitional activities or mind formations. Sometimes they're called one or the other. And then consciousness is the fifth one. That's what makes us up. And so he's saying that the Four Noble Truths are all found in these five aggregates. So later, when he'll say, you know, all craving is, the craving and the clinging comes in those five aggregates. And so that's why we're always trying to work with them to get rid of the wanting to cling to them and think that they're who we are, because they're the opposite of who we are. They're the things we're trying to like unlearn or get rid of. So a lot of this is very repetitious, but yeah, and what, monks, is the Noble Truth of the Origin of Suffering? It is this craving causing renewed existence, accompanied by delight and lust, delighting here and there, craving for sensual pleasures, craving for existence, craving for non-existence. This is called the noble truth of the origin of suffering. So he starts out saying, the first one is the noble truth, the truth of suffering, and he defines that as the aggregates and the clinging, like the form would be our body. So the clinging is we don't want this body to be, you know, we want this body at a certain stage in our lives to just stay there all the time. And then he talks about the truth of suffering and the origin. The one I just read was about the origin of suffering and the noble truth of the cessation of suffering. It is the remainderless fading away and cessation of that same craving, its giving up, relinquishment, freedom from it, non-attachment. This is called the noble truth of the cessation of suffering. And then the noble truth, what monks is the noble truth of the way leading to the cessation of suffering? It is just the noble eightfold path. That is right view, right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, right concentration. This is called the noble truth of the way leading to the cessation of suffering. These are the four noble truths. Therefore, monks, an exertion should be made to understand these four truths. So he talks on a lot in other suttas about how we work with those. Like the first, we just have to understand, and then we have to abandon that clinging and attachment. And so he's listing and giving pieces of so many suttas, and so you're going to learn those four noble truths. They're really the essence of the teachings, but they're spread over lots and lots of teachings. So they'll be described different ways depending on the teaching that someone's talking about. But I find this book is a really good one. But if you haven't done sutta studies yet, Bhikkhu Bodhi can be a little bit, the book we're using on harmony and social harmony and is a very good book. It's written the same way this one is, but at times it can almost be confusing because he's got pieces from this sutta and this sutta and this sutta and in it. It can become, I think the group, we've been working on the book for a couple of years, and we're all ready to move to a different book. Mm-hmm. Or maybe just taking one sutta at a time and learning how to break it down. Because the Buddha does that. He puts things come together from a lot of different teachings he does. So this way you're getting all of those teachings, but you've got to kind of remember, you know, your mind has to remember, oh, that's over here and this is over there and that's but this book is great. Noble Truths, Noble Path, the heart essence of the Buddha's original teachings. So in terms of getting the original teachings, I think this book is excellent, but it would be more fun to do it in a class. So what are your questions about the how you feel about the five precepts? Don't forget your microphone.
To me, it's like how to be a better person, just to remember, because really I can react without even thinking. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I was just acting.
Yeah, that's a good way to say it, because we all have that tendency to want to react, and then we have to regret it. because we know it's not how we want to present ourselves in the world.
And also created a lot of suffering.
It, yes.
You know what? Created a lot of suffering. Mm-hmm. I was, seriously, it was like...
Yeah.
I didn't have any power over my mind. It was just reactions or feelings, mm-hmm. and then it created suffering.
And it, and as soon as you say something, then you have, then you've hurt someone else, and you they might not say anything, but then you regret it, because later you think, oh, maybe that was, mm-hmm. you know, upsetting to somebody. Yeah, it's one slip can lead to lots of suffering. And that giving ourselves, by having the precepts and knowing, like, okay, I'm working on these five qualities, and they're always talked about, the Buddha always talks about them as they're training, they're telling us what we need to be training in, not this is how we have to be perfect right now. It's these are the things we can train in that will make us suffer less. And it also helps us be kinder to other people, and you know, it fills a lot of things that we want to bring about in our life. And that the really important one is that being able to pause and breathe and then be more aware of how we're responding or reacting. That saves a lot of saves a lot of suffering. And that happens to people no matter how long they've been studying, you know, it's then you don't need to take the precepts, no. Right? Yeah. Hey, I've got these all nailed down.
For me, I kind of picture it as guardrails, and the more narrow the guardrails get, the more kind of drama you can leave out. And mm-hmm. I see that, like with what you were saying about speech, I'm a reactor and an over-explainer, or I can be. I'm not always. I think I've gotten better, right? But when I don't react and I sit and I say, and let's put that into a social situation with alcohol, right?
Yeah.
And I'm not drinking and I'm saying, and then something happens, and to observe that rather than be a part of it, that's like the more you narrow it, the easier it is to be that in that situation.
Yeah.
I think that discipline is something that I'm seeking to narrow it. And when I say narrow, narrow sounds negative to me. I don't mean narrowing in a negative way. I mean narrowing it in a positive way of being in alignment more. Because, you know, I think we know this. We know not to do harm to others. We know not to lie, right? We know those things, right?
Mm-hmm.
But really looking at each of those and figuring out how to narrow it and tighten things up and button things up and see how things fall into place and align.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think we also begin to understand other people that we know, and we may see, oh, that's a person that always exaggerates or doesn't always necessarily stick to telling the truth. And just knowing that, well, that's not the direction we're focused and going, but we don't have to come down heavy on that person. We can just use that as an example of that's why it's really important to know, like, to really distinguish telling the truth from exaggeration or lying about something or doing that too loosely. And then we can just see and observe other people, but we don't have to be moralizing our issues onto them. I mean, that's that can be helpful for us just to see just the reflection of that. And then, you know, someone who's not used to telling the truth. What was it that J.D. Vance just said recently about the, you know, the Haitians eating the pets? Well, if he had to make up a story to make, to draw people's attention to an important issue, he was going to do it. And I thought, he's just telling people. He will lie to them to get the to get the reaction he wants. And I just thought, hey, that's, isn't that strange that people don't just call him on that right away? So anyway, we don't have to, we can see that and see the trouble it might get those people into, and we don't have to like go after people and try to tell them they have to make the same choices we do. But those, all of the precepts are really things that we can work on for a long time too, because we can, we get more and more subtle in terms of how we understand the precepts and how they relate to us. So, you know, the one about not to kill a living thing. At first we usually all think, well, I don't kill anything. But and that will often include even people who are hunters or people who fish. And they're defining it in a different, in a different way. And so sometimes after maybe some years working with the precepts, someone might decide, I don't think I'm going to go hunting this year. It doesn't feel right anymore. But they still like to fish. And then, you know, that might drop away later. And it's interesting to me because I never wanted to hunt. But for a while, my ex-husband, well, he was a big fisherman. And so I didn't think much about that, and it didn't occur to me that it took a while for me to even see that in the same light as hunting. Mm-hmm. So, and we, in our relationship to things, like the Buddha never said that anybody had to be a vegetarian, and he was very clear that that would never be a rule that he would impose either on the monastics or on lay people. And for the monastics, he knew that people, you know, the monastics depended on other people to feed them. And it would be terrible for a monastic to tell a person who was offering their best food to that monk, if that monastic looked at it and said, well, I can see there's some meat in there, I can't eat that. That wouldn't work in that kind of interdependent relationship between monastics and the people. That was kind of, the people took care of the monastics that way, and the monastics took care of the people by teaching them and helping them. But he also thought it was, I think that we were talking about how intelligent the Buddha was. I think he knew too how, there were people who sometimes had nothing to eat. They weren't able to farm. There were people in the world who had to eat meat because they couldn't grow crops or anything. So I think he knew more of the world than, you know, he could have had that ability to see further than where he was specifically at that time, that to tell people they couldn't kill anything, there would be people who would starve to death. You know, and I think about like people live in the tundra and live where you can't grow anything. You can't survive if you're not willing to hunt. So we all have to come at these. We have to come at these precepts too, not feeling guilty about them, but to really try to really understand why they're important and how they relate to us personally. And for me, the one about not engaging in alcohol and other drugs that can affect the our consciousness, I think those were really important for me because I was kind of at a place, I had been in Al-Anon because my husband was an alcoholic, and I was in Al-Anon for a long time. And then when I was in the Tibetan group, the Shambhala group, when they would have potlucks and gatherings, even at their center, everybody was encouraged to drink and to make toast. Mm-hmm. And I can remember being very uncomfortable because I wasn't drinking. I mean, this is like in the 90s. I wasn't drinking, and that part of that was from because I was in Al-Anon and because I wasn't going to drink with a partner who was an alcoholic. And then to be in a Buddhist setting, and they were, and people would say, you know, why aren't you drinking? And if I said, oh, I'm in a 12-step group, they would assume I was an alcoholic, and they'd go, oh, well, then that's okay. But I was sort of appalled that they were thinking that we all want a toast, so we're all going to be drinking whatever it was, and the drinking would kind of go on. So I think in the Theravadan tradition, I think it's much, that actually appealed to me. It was more clear because it's so clear that if you're drinking and you can't stop it, you know, that you have an issue with stopping at about one drink, you are losing you're losing that ability to slow down with reactions. And, you know, we know we're going to say things that we don't even, might not even remember the next day. But I thought taking them, I mean, for me, it was a time in my life when it was very easy to take those precepts. At other times, it would have been harder. But I thought they were so reasonable, and they made so much sense. If I'm working to clear my mind and to have that, to be mindful, it's impossible to do it with drugs or alcohol or too much food or too much, you know, all kinds of things that we can overindulge in, and we actually can lose our consciousness about it. But that was important, and over the years I've seen how difficult it is for people to even take that precept. And it says a lot about our society, but I think for a lot of people, and I used to be the same way, just having something to drink after work, it was like, oh, now I can relax. Mm-hmm. And that one, some people have to ease into it, and they have to go with their, you know, make their own choices about it. But I think, So other questions? I've talked a lot, so you guys haven't had a chance to ask questions.
I don't know if this is a question or so much of a comment, but
yeah.
I didn't expect to quit drinking, but I did, and like I'm happy about that. Like, this is good. I feel the difference. I like not saying things that I regret the next day. But what I find interesting is I feel like those attachments with like food, mm-hmm. pot, alcohol, those things are like in a pot, right? And if you take away this part of the pot, like, here I am eating the cookies over here, and it's like, on one hand, it's kind of funny to observe, because I see exactly what I'm doing. Like,
uh-huh.
Like, of course I'm going to order cheesecake when we're out to dinner and I'm the only one not drinking. Of course, you know.
Yeah.
And it's that sugar fix. And so sometimes I don't know what to do with that when I see myself, as being really honest, replacing one with the other, even though I still think that the cheesecake's better than the drinks, you know?
Right.
It's interesting to me how the mind is like, oh, you're not going to do that. Well, we're going to go over here, you know?
That means we can do some of this.
Yeah, so I think that's something with this journey I'm interested in seeing is, as the lane narrows, like what's going to happen with that?
Yeah, that's a really good point. And that's a good thing to watch, too. That's a good thing to be aware of. Yeah, I will drink kombucha sometimes when I'm with, like, some family members that I know they're going to be drinking. I'll have, if, you know, I don't like to drink soda, but I'll drink kombucha if I bring it myself.
Sometimes that makes you feel elevated, doesn't it?
Well, I remember years ago I was in Tennessee, and my brother and I went to get some barbecue at a place that was cooking everything outdoors. But they had a brewery, and they had alcoholic kombucha, which I didn't even know was a thing. So I got a kombucha and found out it was alcoholic as I was getting it, so I thought, I'm going to try this. And it was a wallop because I hadn't been drinking at all, so it really goes.
I ordered a mocktail the other day, and it was so good, and I felt my filter go off, and shoulders loosen up, and I said, that is the best mocktail I've ever had. And like, he came back, and he's laughing, and he's like, there was alcohol in that. And I thought, well, first of all, don't laugh until I tell you I'm not an alcoholic, because that's very not funny if I am. You know?
Yeah, yeah.
But it was so funny, I was in my head, I'm thinking, I'm going to bring my husband back here so we can try this mocktail, it loosens you up, you know.
Yeah, that's how that kombucha was. It was like, wow, this is... So, questions. Do you have any... Is there anything you're uncomfortable about the precepts or the...
I'm excited.
And homework or suggested homework?
You know, the books, what we've always had are the recommended books.
Yeah.
But I think if you read a book like this or had it, and I don't know if Tessa has it here or not, but this book would cover everything that, you know, everything and more. It would be a good book to study. But what I notice is it has a lot of concepts that for a beginner aren't going to be beginner concepts, like even putting the aggregates in with the Four Noble Truths.
Mm-hmm.
It's a little bit like, now what are these aggregate things? Mm-hmm. And you can get sidetracked in that. But homework, I think just looking, if you'd like to journal, it's good. It can be good to kind of journal your adventure.
Mm-hmm.
Just with your training, and don't think of it as something that you have to confess or feel guilty about if you don't stay like right on target, because they really are just training. We're finishing.
Okay.
So I think that's one of the most important things anybody will say is don't feel guilty about the precepts, feeling like you're sort of nailed down with her. And you know, make your own. Some things like speech is always one too, that we want to be better all the time than we are at the time, right? So thank you.
Thank you so much.
Yeah. Now. Yeah.